Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the final lecture in the spring series of the Vancouver Institute. It's a pleasure this evening to have with us Professor Martin Esslin. Professor Esslin is trained in Vienna. He joined the BBC in 1940 and became head of the drama department of the BBC in 1963. Recently, he has become professor of drama at Stanford University. He is the author of a number of books, including one entitled The Theater of the Absurd, and that is his topic for this evening. Professor Esslin.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like first to thank you for having come in such impressive numbers, which makes me honored and also nervous. And I'd also like to express my thanks for the Cecil H. and Ida Green Fund that have actually brought me to this beautiful part of the world, which I enjoyed very much today because it was such a wonderful day. When I was asked to talk about the theater of the absurd, I was in a way, put face to face with a certain amount of difficulty because I published my book on the theater of the absurd almost 20 years ago, and in a way I felt that it would be difficult to approach the subject from a different angle so that those people who have read the book shouldn't really get it all once more. So I decided perhaps to approach it this time from a kind of autobiographical angle and to start with how I personally came to get involved in this subject, which in many ways I'm very proud of having dealt with. In other ways, it has haunted me in a curious manner. The very first time that I got out of England after the war, after one had been cooped up in England during the war, was immediately after the war, I think it was in 1946, when I finally succeeded in amassing enough money to visit my father, whom I hadn't seen. He lived in Switzerland. And at that time, one couldn't travel directly yet from England to Zurich, where my father was, because the railways weren't working quite well yet. And one had to change in Paris from the Gare du Nord to the Gare de l'Est. And so I decided I would spend the night in Paris in between the two trains. And I arrived and I walked down the Boulevard de la Madeleine and I thought perhaps I'd go to the theater. And I saw that Jouvet was appearing at the Athénée in a play by Giraudoux called L'Apollon de Bellac. And so I went in and I got a ticket. I was very impressed by the play by Giraudoux, but I was completely bowled over by the other play that was being given, because L'Apollon de Bellac is a short curtain raiser, which was given at the same time, which was by an author I'd never heard of, and which called Les Bonnes, The Maids, by Jean Genet. And so very, very early on, I actually saw, by pure chance, and I always believe in fate playing its benevolent part in one's life, I saw the first production of Genet's The Maids very, very early on. And in the course of my later subsequent travels to Paris, at that time I was still working in the overseas service of the BBC, and I was occasionally sent to cover NATO conferences and similar things in Paris. I was a political commentator. I used to spend my evenings in Paris by looking for avant-garde theaters. And so I remember one evening, for example, in the 50s, when I was walking down the left bank and I saw a play announced which was called Le Ping Pong, by Arthur Adamov. And I thought, this looks interesting, because there had some actors in it that I knew, Jean Martin. And I went in, and I was in this little Left Bank Theater, and there were about four people there, and it was a very dismal looking situation. And the curtain rose, and this very strange play began to unroll itself. It is a play in which two young men, at the beginning of their lives, and they're still students, become fascinated by pinball machines. Oh. And they become fascinated in their technology, in their mathematics, in their sociology, and they become so fascinated by them that their entire life is shaped by their being hung up on pinball machines. They get involved with the rather shady, gangster-like mafia that runs them. They, of course, fall in love with the girl that works for the boss, and so on. And so we see their entire life in terms of their addiction to pinball machines. And as the play proceeded, I became more and more fascinated by this absolutely brilliant concept by which the Marxist idea of alienation, of one's life being shaped by the material basis of one's existence, was made clear in a way that no sociological essay could ever do it. And I remember, as I walked out of the theater with the other four or five people, I saw a somewhat disheveled little man in a beret standing outside counting them, and I felt this must be the author. And indeed, of course, later on, when I was writing the book, I met Artyom Adamov, and indeed it was him. Then, in 1955, I saw the London production of Waiting for Godot. And this, of course, as for many people who saw that, was also a great turning point in my life. And in 1957, again, by pure chance, I saw one of the earliest productions of Pinter's The Birthday Party. Now, each of these experiences of theater were, for me, really tremendous, because tremendous insights were being opened up, and I found that these plays were not only funny, but moving and tremendously relevant. And each time I then looked at the reviews of these plays, I found that most of the critics concerned thought that they were really contemptible, that they were bad, they were worse than bad. And one also got the feeling that audiences were very disconcerted by them. This is why I wrote an article around about 1959 for the Tulane Drama Review, which was one of the good American quarterlies, on scholarly quarterlies on drama. And I didn't know how to entitle this review, because I felt that all these plays had something in common, and so I gave it the title The Theater of the Absurd, and this is what I have had like a millstone around my neck ever since. And as a result, I was then asked to write a book about it, and the rest is not so interesting. Now, the point why I'm recounting this really is to explain how one comes to write a book which, for want of a better word, one would call a critical book, or a book of theatrical theory or something like that. I very strongly feel that the impulse, the motivation for such a book is very important. And my motivation simply was to make a case for these plays that had moved me so deeply, and to make other people, and particularly critics, more able to see what it was all about, and to appreciate what it was all about, and to get all the tremendous emotional and intellectual stimulus out of these plays that I had got out of them. This then was the genesis of this very curious collection of writers. Now, I'd like to make another point. Having told you how this came about, I want to disclaim any deeper conceptual validity for an expression like Theatre of the Absurd. It really was a question that I liked these plays, and I had written a book about them, and I felt I ought to give the book a title. One of the things which pursues me is that people take such a title or such a category so seriously as if it were a logical concept on the same of the same validity as Kant's philosophical categories. This, of course, is not what it is. It's simply an impressionistic device to explain that plays and works of art, of theatrical art, which have very little in common, have that in common, which enables me as a critic to say, if you don't understand it, understand that, and then you'll understand the diversity of these plays as well as what they have in common. I sometimes use the example, when I'm accused of having put things together that don't belong together and so on, or that are very different. And indeed, when the other day at Stanford we had a visit by Eugène Ionesco, one of the great authors that I've dealt with in my book, and he's very often asked, are you a member of the Theatre of the Absurd? And he says, never heard of it. And of course, he's absolutely entitled to this, because a category like this is not something that is conscious in the people who are practicing the methods that are being described. It is something that is applied from the outside as a tool of description, as an aid in the descriptive process, and it has no validity except that it helps in this descriptive process. I sometimes use the example of saying that, for example, we talk about different prehistorical periods, the Neolithic and the Paleolithic. Now, if you'd asked a member of those civilizations whether he was a Paleolithic, he wouldn't have known what you were talking about, yet it's a valid concept, because it is based on descriptive things that come together. And in the same way, if people say, how can you put Harold Pinter into the same category with Ionesco? They are so different. I say, yes, but you see, a mouse and a giraffe are very different, yet they have enough in common to be both described as mammals. And in the same way, very different things can be put under one descriptive label if certain things, like the formation of their skeleton or the way that they reproduce, has something in common. What then is it that these writers have in common, which still, I think, entitles one, with all due caution that I've outlined, to talk of them as being in one sort of group? Let me start by giving an example in analyzing one or two of the plays, simply to show you what I feel that they have in common. The most paradigmatic of these plays is probably Waiting for Godot by Beckett. And I think that Samuel Beckett is one of the greatest writers of our century. Now, in Waiting for Godot, you have an attempt to do the paradoxical, to do the impossible. Because for centuries, drama has been defined as an action which proceeds from one point, develops, and then comes to an end at another point. Here you have a play in which the point of the play is that literally nothing happens, and that at the end of the play, the situation is exactly the same as it was at the beginning, and in between, nothing has happened either. So this, in a way, is a paradoxical approach to drama, and it's a very difficult thing to accomplish, namely to make the action of not having any action an interesting action. And of course, the critics who condemned the play in the beginning were going by very well-known, well-defined old rules, namely that this can't be done, and there is no action, therefore there's no play. What then is such a play about, and how does it express what it is about? In Waiting for Godot, which no doubt everybody knows, so I don't want to go too deeply into it, you have two people on an empty road. They don't know why they are there, but they feel they must have an appointment. They're standing by a tree, and they think that somebody is going to come for them and save them from their situation. This doesn't happen. In the first act, they meet two other people who are running around wildly, also looking for something, and they don't find it. And in the second act, the whole thing happens exactly the same again, exactly the same pattern, although different in detail. Now, the point of such a play is the repetition of the pattern and the non-action of the play is expressed by the fact that the two acts are totally symmetrical. Now, you can only see that when the second act is completed, because while it is proceeding, you don't know that the two will be identical structures. So here, the meaning of a play is expressed entirely through its form, through its shape, and through the image which it presents. Now, the image of two people waiting for, who don't know where they come from, and who are waiting for an appointment which they might have, but which they don't know whether they will have, struck me from the beginning as being, in the same way as I mentioned the ping pong by Adamov, as a very brilliant image and metaphor for the human situation itself. Because what it is about is not Godot. People are always asking, why don't you find out who Godot is at the end of the play? And Beckett himself, when asked about this, always says, well, you know, if I knew, I would have put it in the play. I don't know what they're waiting for. And it would be very unfair if I knew what they're waiting for and then withheld this information from the audience right to the end. So it is not really about Godot. It is about waiting. And it is about the process of waiting as an image, a metaphor, for the way in which we experience time, the main dimension of our lives. This is one of the images in the play, which is, of course, a very intricate pattern of images. The other image, and there's a very brilliant essay about this by Günther Anders, is that, are they really waiting for something? That is not really the point of the play. The point of the play is that these two people find themselves on this road and they don't know where they came from and why they are there. Now, this is an image of the human situation. All of us haven't asked to be suddenly projected into the world. We all don't know where we come from and why we are there. And the point of the play, again, is that man, being a logical being, says, if we are here, not knowing why we are here, there must be a point in it, so we must have an appointment. We must be here for a purpose, the purpose must be the appointment. So that the waiting process really comes out of the logical conclusion which one takes from the fact that one is there, not having been asked to be there. One feels, well, perhaps somebody must have asked one to be there. So you have the appointment. Now, this is just a brief outline, as I say, most people know the play better than I do, of the basic approach of a play like this. It is an approach in which the thing that is being said is not said in the words that are being spoken, but it is said through images, through things that are actually happening in front of our eyes and which are happening according to certain structural and formal patterns
where the patterns of the happening are more important than anybody being able to say what it is and why it is and what is going to happen next. In my book, I put this once, I think, as saying that in the traditional theater, a story is being told, and the audience, if the play is any good, is in suspense, and they are constantly asking from minute to minute, what's going to happen next? And then the next thing happens, and finally the plot becomes more and more complicated, and in the end there's a solution. In this kind of play, like Waiting for Godot, but most of the ones that are in this category, the question is not what's going to happen next, but the question is what is happening? And you have to wait to the end, for example, of Waiting for Godot, to see that what was happening was a symmetrical pattern of two acts repeating each other's structure. In the traditional theory of drama, and this is why these plays were being rejected both by critics and audiences in the beginning, people come into the theater with the expectation that they will in fact be told a story which has an ending, and in the end they will be able to say, we saw this and this happening in this sequence. In this theater, the suspense element of this kind does not exist. A new suspense element has been added, and this I think is the main innovation that these authors have given to the art of drama, and that suspense element is the suspense of seeing the structure gradually unfold and gradually realizing the symmetry or the shape of the fact of the structure that unfolds. Not always an identical symmetrical structure. It may be a structure of intensification or a structure of running down. And this is a new kind of suspense, comparable to the static development, for example, in the way in which a flower in one of those films where the opening of the flower is speeded up, gradually unfolding, and you're watching with breathless suspense what the final shape will be as the flower gradually unfolds itself from its bud to its full splendor. In the normal traditional theater, you are going there to see a story being told, and in that sense, the theater has an epic quality. In this theater, you are watching an image unfolding and a structure of metaphors, because all these images are metaphors. You're watching these metaphors unfolding, and at the end, you are admiring the symmetry, the shape of this metaphorical structure. And in that sense, this kind of theater is doing exactly the same as lyrical poetry is doing, which also doesn't tell a story, but gives you a more or less complicated pattern of metaphors which finally add up to insights about the human condition and human emotions. In this sense, I think, the plays of the Theatre of the Absurd can be described as a lyrical theater, as against what Brecht was aiming at when he talked about an epic theater. Why then the label Theater of the Absurd? Most of the plays concerned, and this is again a very important characteristic of much of modern literature, are on the one hand extremely funny, and Waiting for Godot, which I use as an example, or Le Ping Pong, which I use as another example by Adamov, are farcical. When Beckett himself directed a production of Waiting for Godot at the Schiller Theater in Berlin, which really is the sort of authentic production of Waiting for Godot, he made the characters of Estragon and Vladimir, the two men who are waiting, very, very reminiscent of the kind of comic pair of comedians like Laurel and Hardy in the American film comedy of the 20s and 30s. And he directed the play as wildly farcical. So this is, on the whole, a comic theater. On the other hand, of course, it deals with very deep metaphysical subjects, such as the condition of man who doesn't know where he's coming from and he doesn't know where he's going to. So that this theater is a very distinct tragicomical concept of the world. And it is, because it is not trying to come to conclusions at the end of the line, and because it very often, mostly, starts with a very vague kind of exposition, so you don't know who the people are very well, and you don't know what will become of them in the end, it is an extremely skeptical theater. It is a theater that doesn't really want to admit any definite answers about the human condition. And in this sense, I felt, when I was writing my article and then the book, that it was a reflection of current existential philosophy, Sartre, Camus, Heidegger, and so on, going back to the first existentialist, Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish, great Danish philosopher of the 19th century, in which the basic point of departure is that whereas idealistic philosophies have always started from the assumption that the ultimate realities of life could be known, and indeed in religious concepts, in religious worldviews were known through revelation, that the world was not accessible to the human mind to be totally understood. And this is why Sartre and Camus, particularly after the Second World War, coined this phrase that the world to man must appear absurd. This is not to say that the world is absurd, because we are not in a position, this is an agnostic philosophy, to say whether it's absurd or not. All that it is saying is that our conception of our own limited time span on Earth and the limited way in which our minds work is in fact such that we will never know the ultimate answers, and that to us the world must therefore appear as not having a discernible raison d'être, a discernible purpose or structure, whatever you would call it, and that to us therefore the world must appear absurd, and that in order to give it some sense we must structure our own limited system of values and system of commitments to our own life purposes. And I felt that this particular form of theater was an exact reflection of that philosophy. Of course, again, it is not presupposed that all the people who write this kind of thing are all learned philosophers who have studied with Sartre or Heidegger. But it is, of course, something which is in the spirit of our times, because it reflects the cultural and philosophical situation of our times, and particularly after the Second World War in France, where most of this originated, where the previous secure, well-known systems of values had all, under the impact of the collapse of 1940, quite obviously got a very, very severe shaking. So here you have, then, a movement in the theater of writers who are trying to express the bewilderment, but also the sense of wonder that modern man feels when faced with the world. The unified world views, whether it was Christianity or idealistic Platonic philosophy, or indeed the belief in liberal progress, that came out of Darwin and the utilitarians in the 19th century had been shattered, and that the world, therefore, was a highly mysterious thing which has to be approached with extreme caution if one wants to be honest. I remember I was mentioning that one of the great examples, great experiences I had with the early plays of Theatre of the Absurd was Pinter's The Birthday Party. And this is a play in which, very realistic play in a way, a very realistic boarding house in the south of England somewhere between Brighton and Eastbourne, or one of those places, where a young man has sought refuge from something. He doesn't know what. This is again very much a situation like the in Waiting for Godot. He has sought refuge there. He's afraid of something. He says that he once was a pianist, but one doesn't really believe that he's a pianist. One doesn't know that he was a pianist. And then suddenly two men appear, one called Goldberg, the other one McCann, sort of music hall figures of the Irishman and the Jew, and they seem to be some sort of terrorists, and they terrorize him, and finally they break his glasses and they take him away speechless. He's lost the power of speech, dressed in a bowler hat and pinstripe trousers, the uniform of the English bourgeois civil servant, and take him away in a big black car. Again, a very mysterious, unexplained pattern of images. And I remember I was at that time still in the overseas service of the BBC, and I could write things on cultural events. I got so interested that I said I'd write a program on Harold Pinter. I invited him to lunch. And I said to him I was fascinated by this play. It obviously has marvelous dialogue, but why do you have a situation which looks like a crime story, a thriller, and yet we never know why this poor man is being beaten up and taken away? And I said to him, I have various theories of what it might mean. For example, that as the young man is a pianist and he has sought refuge and they finally take him away dressed like a civil servant, perhaps the play is about the artist who, in order to make a living, is then forced back into a bourgeois, a 9-to-5 bank clerk type of job, and the play is therefore about the artist who can't be an artist and has to become socialized as a bourgeois. And I said, is that what this was all about? And he said, I like this explanation enormously. Of course, I never thought of it, but I accept it. And then I said, well, at the same time, I also thought that perhaps this was a kind of mystery play, an everyman play, because after all, these two people who break his glasses and he becomes then blind and speechless and is then taken away in a black car, they may be the angels of death. And perhaps he fled from them because he didn't want to die, and they have caught up with him and they take him away. So this can be a kind of mystery play a la Everyman, the dying of any man at all. And he said, oh, I like that even better. Of course, what it amounts to is that it's about neither of these things or of any other explanation that you could find, but it is about the anxiety that everyone in us feels. Everybody has something that he's afraid of, that he wants to hide from, and the nightmare that this will then happen is a general human feeling. But I also asked Harold Pinter at that time, people liked the play, but it had bad reviews and it failed terribly. It ran for a week and it only took about £100. Harold Pinter in his home has the check framed of the what he got for the first play that he ever had, and it was very little. People were indignant, really, that they were made to think it's a crime story, but you never actually explained what it was that Stanley had been, the hero of the play, and what happened to him in the end. Why did you do that? Why don't you give the exposition? It could cost you nothing to put that in. And he said, and it's very characteristic, I think, and you have to take this as, I think, being true of all these authors, that he said, you see, I think that it would be tremendously presumptuous of any human being to claim that he knows what makes another human being tick. And he says that, for example, the people he knew best, his own family, he wouldn't really go under oath to say what makes them tick, because one has no first-hand evidence of what goes on in another person's mind. And he then added, and this is, I think, the decisive point that I want to make, that the presumption that the author was a kind of omniscient, godlike creature who knew the motivations of all his characters, which was throughout literature always assumed to be necessary, was in fact a conceit, a presumption, as he put it, as a being a Cockney, a bloody liberty. And here I think we are again at one of the sources of this whole worldview, because if you have a very firmly structured sense of purpose, of ethical purpose and of philosophical purpose or religious purpose in the world, then the author can in fact say, that's a good man, that's a bad man, he does it because of that, he does it because of that. But the moment this firm ground is taken away from under you, and all you have is your own experience to go by, the point of existentialism really, then all these things become relative and mysterious, and you can only say, well, that is happening, but I don't know why. To continue my account of this conversation, Harold Pinter, which is very interesting for me, because many of the ideas in my book came from it, actually. I said to him, well, if you don't know what makes these characters tick, and if you don't know what happens to them in the end, why write about them? And he said, well, first of all, I want to express my own experience of the world. And my experience of the world is that I see people doing things, and I wonder why they do them. And I find that I don't know why they do them. So this is the, as it were, the experience, the emotion. When every artist expresses his own existential emotion, that I want to express. But he also said that, in fact, there's a fallacy to think that it is necessary to know all these things. Because if you walk down the street and you see two people fighting, there's always a crowd around them, and they don't know why these people are fighting. And when the police car comes and takes them away, they'll never know what happened to them in the end. And yet they are watching them. Why are they watching them? Because the fight expresses something about the nature of society, about the nature of man, about the clash of personalities, and a whole lot of things which are very interesting. So that in that sense, I think, and much of modern literature, not only the drama, I mean, all this, of course, you can find parallels in Kafka, in Joyce, in Proust, in the Nouveau Roman of Rob Grier, Nathalie Sarraute. All of modern literature, which responds to this particular crisis of confidence in Western society, is in fact structured in this way, and based on this kind of relativism and the need to go back to one's own experience with all its undefined areas, with all its mysterious elements. And of course, if one thinks about all these matters, and if one saw these playwrights doing something which seemed to be very novel, one could, of course, go back into the history of literature, and of drama particularly, and find lots and lots of antecedents, and this is why I put in a chapter again in order to convince the critics that I wasn't just inventing this out of nothing, of examples of how in previous literature the same kind of thing had also existed and always been there, but not so prominently put into the foreground. For example, the concept that the theater can be a pattern of concrete images, concrete metaphors on the stage, is of course commonplace. If you think of the greatest plays, if you think of Oedipus Blinded, that's a great metaphor for the blindness and sinfulness of man. If you think of King Lear going mad and naked on the heath in the storm, this is one of the great images of the isolation and at the same time courage and precariousness of the situation of man. The difference, I think, here is
that whereas in the traditional theater, the author started from the need to tell the story of Oedipus and to tell the story of Lear,
and in telling it, incidentally created these powerful, concretized
lyrical metaphors on the stage. In this kind of theater, these concretized, powerful lyrical metaphors are the starting point,
and any plot that is around them
is incidental. So that whereas, let us
say, in Shakespeare,
he started with wanting to tell the story of a king and incidentally had these images, Beckett wanted to show the image of the two men waiting and incidentally had to invent whatever plot there is in Waiting for Godot. So this is where it comes in differently. The symbolic and allegorical nature of this kind of theater also struck me as being very, very traditional. I was already saying that if you look at a play like The Birthday Party by Pinter, one could see it as almost a repetition of the old mystery play of Everyman. In medieval theater, there were allegories of this kind in which virtues and vices were fighting for the soul of man, and all sorts of other concretized forces in the human soul were being put on the stage. So there again, you have a symbolic, an allegorical theater, because what they two have in common is that in this allegorical theater also the audience had to decide what it was that they were seeing. They had to realize, ah, that is an image of man being torn from between the different sins, etc., etc. So this is again a traditional element in it, which has resurfaced in this kind of theater after a very long interval of non-allegorical and non-symbolic drama. Also, I felt that all these plays are, in fact, because they are seeing the world with a kind of skeptical, wondering eye, the mystery of not being able to penetrate the motivations of other people, that the world that way becomes very dreamlike. It becomes opaque. Again, dream is a symbolic language. And again, of course, in modern literature, the prevalence of dream literature, whether in the works of Kafka or in Strindberg's dream play, is something which has gone very far back into literature. If you think of Piers Plowman and The Pilgrim's Progress as being dream literature and allegorical to boot, you will see that this again is something which is by no means new under the sun and is merely a revival of ancient traditions in human literature. And equally, the kind of element of nonsense that is in these plays, where the absurdity of the situation or the one's inability to discern what the world means is very often, particularly in the plays of Ionesco, expressed in wildly nonsensical dialogue. Ionesco's play, The Bald Prima Donna, for example, or I don't know whether it's called in America, it's probably called The Bald Soprano. I don't know in which version, in the English version, it's called one, the American, the other. In Ionesco's play, he was struck by the senselessness of most dialogue. So he made people say, today is Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, and it doesn't make any difference, so they say it all, one after the other. This tradition of nonsense literature, which of course always conceals a deep sense, long before absurdism was thought of. So these, I think, are the literary antecedents. We could go very, very far back as antiquity, really. The theatrical antecedents, the use of allegorical, grotesque, comic, tragicomic effects also is highly traditional. I've already mentioned that Beckett's plays, in many cases, are patterned on Chaplin or Laurel and Hardy type of figures, and also the pratfalls, the knockabout character of these plays also comes from there. Historically, if one wanted to draw their genealogy, and this I don't want to do now because it would lead too far, of course, this literature comes out of Surrealism, out of Dadaism, and in the 19th century, out of writers like Apollinaire and Alfred Jarry. Well, these are some of the things that I tried to say in my book about the theater of the absurd. This group of writers came to the fore in the late 40s and early 50s. They had their biggest vogue in the mid-60s. What of the future? Quite clearly, the vogue of the theater of the absurd, as it is described in my book, is now practically over. This, again, is by no means a phenomenon which should fill one with surprise or dismay. All literary movements have reach a peak and then merge again into the mainstream of literary history. I think in our time, with the mass media, and if I may add, the critics coming in so quickly, this happens more quickly. I remember with what dismay or with what pleasure, I don't know which way I should put it, I noticed that when 10 years after the first performance of Waiting for Godot in London, where all the critics, with very few exceptions, Harold Hobson, I think, was the only honorable exception, had said that this is total nonsense, nobody can understand a word of it, when 10 years later there was a revival of it at the Royal Court Theatre in London, most of the critics said, this is an excellent play, it's a classic. The only thing that's wrong with it is too obvious in its meaning. And this, I think, is, of course, partly the fault of critics like myself, who over-explained these things. And so in a way I was dismayed, in another way I was rather pleased that everybody had accepted my explanations. But the fact is that once something that has been novel and surprising and scandalous and shocking has become explained, has become part of the generally accepted currency, at least of the more sophisticated playgoers in places like Paris and London, then it can't have the same surprising, shocking, novel, exciting effect as it had when it was new. I often quarrel with people who dismiss a literary movement or a phenomenon by saying, well, it was just a passing fashion. I am a strong believer in fashion, in the sense that, certainly in the theater, one of the greatest advantages, one of the greatest thrills in the theater is novelty. One goes to the theater to be surprised, to have something new. This is why I personally am very happy as a critic to get tickets for first nights. because I'm sitting in front of the curtain, I'm going to see something that nobody has seen before, that I haven't had pre-chewed by the critics or by literature courses, that will be something that really can surprise me. I want to be surprised. I want to be astonished. And this, of course, wears off too. Therefore, it is quite clear that in order to preserve this quality, modes and fashions, if you want to use the ugly word, must change. And they do change. It's a good thing that they change. If one wanted to write a kind of natural history or phenomenology of how these things work, you'll find that writers like Ibsen at first cause a tremendous shock. I've just been recently writing something on Ibsen, looking up reviews of Rosmersholm in London in 1891, where the critics say, this is totally incomprehensible. We don't even know whether it's a good play because we don't know what it's all about. Today, a play like Rosmersholm is just over-clear. If there's anything wrong with it, it's too clear. And in the same way, everything that is new has created this kind of incomprehension. And then there's a second phase where it becomes understood and it becomes appreciated, it becomes very famous. Then usually when the poet or playwright has died, there's a reaction against it. People say, oh yes, it's old hat, and it's the fashion of yesterday. And then, after about 50 years, the thing writes itself, and a writer like Ibsen is now coming back on the 150th anniversary of his birth into being recognized as one of the great playwrights of all time, and finds his place between the shock of novelty, the uninterestingness of being the fashion of yesterday, and his eternal values. I personally believe that the greatest writers in the Theatre of the Absurd group of writers will in fact undergo the same kind of process. This has already happened with somebody like Beckett, who has had the Nobel Prize, with Ionesco, who has been made a member of the Académie Française after everybody had said only 20 years earlier that he was destroying the French language into nonsense and gibberish. And I think that now there will be a trough in their reputation because it is yesterday's fashion, and gradually the greater works among these plays and the greater writers among the playwrights will in fact be recognized as great representatives of world literature of all time. What then happens, however, is, and this again I think is true of all innovative and interesting and important writers in the theater or in any other form of literature, is that each of these innovators adds some new methods to the total methodology, to the total toolkit that is at the disposal of the people who are practicing that art. The classical tragedy added something, the romantics added something, the naturalists added something to our total technique of drama, and the absurdists have added an enormous amount of new devices, new methods, new conventions that are totally acceptable now because they have been overexplained to the public. And I don't think that there's any major playwright today who in one way or another is not using the techniques which the absurdists have added. Allegory, symbolism, concretized images, patterns that unfold, all these things have become dream situations, have become commonplace. And if you look at the best playwrights now, people like Edward Albee, Edward Bond, anybody you would think of among the younger generation, people like Sam Shepard or David Mamet, they are all deeply influenced by this, although they don't simply adhere to this particular movement. They have other axes to grind, but the effect of the technical innovations, the new things that are added to the general instrumentarium, the instruments that a writer has at his disposal are now commonplace and are being very, very widely used. And in that sense, I think the absurdist theater has greatly contributed and has re-entered into the mainstream of literary development. Of course, the greatest writers like Samuel Beckett are still progressing and writing very different, very new, and more exciting works which deepen the tendencies that were present in their early works. The latest plays by Beckett, very short, compressed plays like Footfalls, That Time, or his television play, The Ghost Trio, or But the Clouds, which were done on the BBC last year, are, as it were, the theater of the absurd carried to its utmost concentration and to the furthest extreme that you can go. Because these plays are very, very short, and they totally concentrate on the image. They are, in fact, images and hardly anything else. So that, for example, the fact that Beckett has gone into writing television plays is, in fact, simply a logical conclusion of his concentration on the most concise form of putting an image before an audience. And these are tremendously refined, as yet, for a general public, very, very obscure, but beautiful and brilliant works, which I think, in the form in which Beckett himself has put them onto the videotape or the film, will become very, very great classics. They are very, very compressed, deeply felt images. They have been published as texts, but the texts give you no idea of how beautiful and impressive they are in reality. You actually have to see these images. It's already gone beyond the point of merely being a text. This then is something which, having asked to talk about the theater of the absurd, I feel sums up some of my feelings about it now, almost 20 years after I wrote this book. I personally think that the greatest contribution that this absurdist theater has made to the art of theater is that it finally succeeded, I think, after a period in which the theater had become very commonplace and prosaic in the way it dealt with psychological problems in a drawing room comedy style, that it has re-established the primacy of the poetic in the theater. And this is, I think, why this kind of theater, which instead of calling it theater of the absurd, I would now prefer call a theater of concretized stage metaphors, ultimately a lyrical theater, a poetical theater, is so important. Because I very strongly believe that the greatest thing that the stage can do is to show us the poetic and to bring poetry in the deepest sense to the largest possible numbers of people. Answer questions. Yeah.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Esslin has indicated that he would be very pleased to entertain questions from the audience. Yes.
You would agree that history itself, on its much larger stage, produces dramas of the kind you so clearly described. The reign of Henry VIII in England or of Calvin in Geneva?
Certainly, except that history takes a long time and the theater compresses this kind of event into a consumable capsule in 2 or 3 hours. But I absolutely agree. I mean, the greatest drama is the drama of history. But, I mean, even the historian who deals with it at length has to compress it. And drama is one of the ways in which the essence of history and of the human situation can in fact be very economically distilled into a portable form, as it were. But I do entirely agree with you.
You mentioned the comic aspect of the Theater of the Absurd in that very haunting play of Beckett's, Happy Days. What is comic?
Well, I repeat the question because I think the acoustic from there is not so good. The question is, I stress the comic aspect of Theatre of the Absurd. What is comic in that very depressing play by Beckett, Happy Days? I have seen productions of it which are extremely comic. Because, you see, what is comic is that somebody who is in that situation is still occupied with such trivial things. You know, this is a play about a woman who in the first act is sinking into the ground up to her waist. In the second act, she has sunk right up to her neck. And she's still preoccupied with where her purse is and whether she has her mirror and her comb and so on. Now, this is, I think, extremely funny because in a way, it shows how human beings in their tragicomic situation are continuing to be preoccupied with the trivialities of their lives, even if they perfectly well know that they won't live very long, you know? I mean, the fact that somebody who is likely to, you know, an old person that is very near to death is still, subscribing to a magazine for another year, you know, and so on, is in fact, I'm not saying that it is funny, but it is something that is incongruous, and in some aspects of it is funny. And of course, it's also very profound, because what Beckett is trying to show is that to be alive at all, even to the last moment, is a matter of continuing to go through the trivialities, you know? I mean, even on the day that your nearest and dearest has died, you still have to have breakfast or, you know, think about what the groceries will be for the next day. And this, I think, is both tragic and comic because the comic lies in the juxtaposition of the metaphysical with the trivial. And that, I think, is comic. And a good production of Happy Days, and that's why the play is called Happy Days, incidentally. This woman is very happy. She doesn't want to know that she's sinking into the ground, as so many of us don't want to know, you know? And there you are, you're laughing about that. That shows you that it is comic. Yes, because precisely what I was just saying, the question was, is heroism a great part in the theater today? Yes, because I think, for example, somebody like Beckett sees the ultimate heroism of the human being in his ability to face the insecurity and uncertainty of the kind of agnostic situation in which he is without flinching. And I think that therefore the highest value in all these plays, if you take a play like Rhinoceros by Ionesco, or Waiting for Godot, or Happy Days, is in fact courage. All these people have the courage to actually recognize what their situation is. That they don't know who's going to come, that they go on doing the trivial things in their lives, that everybody has changed into a monster, but they still hang on to their being human in Rhinoceros. So in fact, I think heroism is the main subject of these plays. But it is a heroism without heroics. It's the heroism of recognizing the inevitable realities of existence, however trivial and sordid they may be. That's the message of these plays, to my mind, which makes them very heroic. Certainly, the courage is their main subject matter.
In the latest play of Beckett, the one on videotape, he said that if you read the script, you will hardly guess that the image can be so beautiful. That brings me to the question, is it then the author or the director that brings that image that should really be the center of all this kind of thing?
Indeed, and that's a very relevant question, and that is why Beckett and Ionesco are now directing their own plays. In other words, they have a very strong idea of the image that they have in their minds. They realize that putting it merely onto the page is not enough, and therefore they are more and more forced to go into the business of actually creating images. And it's, you see, it's one of these things, it's the confluence of all the arts nowadays. I mean, painters have become dramatists, and the dramatists have to become painters. And with the electronic mass media, with videotape and film, the dramatist actually can become a kind of painter by directing his own film. Ionesco was at Stanford only 10 days ago, showing a film in which he not only has written the script, but he has directed it, and he plays the lead in it. And so he really has done everything to embody that image. Now, you will rightly say that this is a curious way to going about creating literature. And the answer of these people would be that they're not really worried about that. They really want to get the images that preoccupy them out of themselves and visible. And however it happens, the better it is. And I think that with the possibility that we now have, which didn't exist in previous generations, that a writer who has a moving, living image involving living people can actually capture those living images on film or videotape, this obviously, this technological advance somehow must be taken into account. And of course, you know that the French film critics and theoreticians talk about the director now as an auteur. So that on the one hand, a great writer or poet like Beckett becomes a director, and a great film director like Godard becomes a poet, because when he makes a film, he creates images which are of the same kind. So they converge as auteur of images, as authors of images, creators of images.
You said that your early experience of theater in Paris was an experience in the theater of alienation. Would you explain how the theater of the absurd, what more it embraces than alienation? Because a great deal of the theater you described is alienation. What else is there?
I think the question was whether the theater that I described in Paris was a theater of alienation. What else there is to the theater of the absurd than alienation? I think the play that I described by Adamov, The Ping Pong, is an example of the Marxist concept of alienation. But of course, it is expressed in theatrical terms, which I would call absurdist. In other words, alienation is a philosophical concept or sociological concept. And the term that I coined of theater of the absurd is a technical concept about methods of theatricalization. Brecht wrote plays about the concept of alienation which were not absurdist, and Adamov wrote a play about the concept of alienation which was absurdist. So these are very related concepts, but one is a philosophical concept and the other one is a theatrical technical concept.
But the birthday party is also alienation.
Yes, it's alienation, but again, it's alienation in the Marxist or sociological sense in its content, and absurdist in its practice, in the way it is done. You see, for example, Sartre and Camus wrote plays about the same subject matter,
and they, after all, they are the inventors of the philosophical concept of the absurd. But these plays are not absurdist because they are done in the conventional theatrical technique. In other words, they are very rationally constructed plays about the irrationality of life, whereas these plays are irrational plays about the irrationality of life. And in the same way, you could say that whereas alienation is a subject matter in a play by Brecht, the absurdist technique is alienation made into theatrical practice. And in that sense, they're slightly different terms.
Comment on the poor French madman, Artaud.
With pleasure. I've just written a book on him, which is published in Penguin Books, series The Modern Masters. Artaud was a great poet. He was also somebody who spent some 8 to 10 years in lunatic asylums. And he was also a surrealist, and he was a director and film actor. He wrote a book called Le Théâtre et son double, The Theatre and its Double, which has been extremely influential in the practices of the theater people who are most concerned with, particularly in France, with putting the theater of the absurd on the stage. The main concept of Artaud was his rejection of the psychological drawing room drama of his time. In other words, he thought that plays in which characters were endlessly discussing with each other whether the wife should go to the lover or the lover should leave the wife were very trivial and unpoetic. So he wanted to reintroduce the magic of the theater, the sense of wonder into the theater, and for that he again attacked the over-rationality, the over-explaining, the over-motivation. If you think of what I was saying about Pinter rejecting the idea that the playwright is an omniscient kind of substitute for God, who knows everything that makes his characters tick, he wanted to introduce a sense of wonder, of mystery, of the unusual, the shocking into the theater. He himself was very unfortunate in his practice. He never really got a chance of putting his ideas into practice, and I even suspect that if he had done so, he wouldn't have been very successful because he was a very odd person and didn't work with other people very well. But his theoretical influence has been immense. I think you are right in calling him a madman. On the other hand, he wrote a very, very beautiful essay on Van Gogh in which he questioned whether the fact that somebody is a madman is in fact such a pejorative term, because Van Gogh wouldn't have been such a good painter if he hadn't been slightly mad. He himself, I think, actually cultivated his madness at great personal cost and suffering in order to be a better artist. Now, this may be a very mad concept, but it's also a very heroic one to come back to the other gentleman. But I've explained my view of Artaud, as I say, at greater length in this short book, which I recommend. I don't. I mean, how do I know whether a new play that I see is a great work or not? I don't know whether it's a great work or not. What happens, and this I think applies to any critic really who's worth his salt, is that you can only go in the first place by your own personal experience and reaction. If I find myself in a theater with tears running down my eyes, I know that I've been moved, you know? Then I use my knowledge of drama and of philosophy and of semantics and whatever other branches of knowledge I have to try and analyze to say, now, why was I so moved by this? You see? So the first experience must be totally naive. The second
step is an analytical experience. And then if I feel that my analysis has actually shown good reasons why I was so moved, and if my analysis, which also has to, as it were, abstract from my personal bias, you know, I may only have been so moved because I'm in love with the actress concerned, you know. So if I subtract my personal bias or my political bias and then say there still seems to be something that is something really solid, then I would stick out my neck and say, well, I may be wrong, but I think this is an important work. And I think this is what any critic can do. Nobody can know what will be a great work in 150 years' time. But some people are perhaps able to point to the importance of a work before the other people have caught on. I mean, for example, in the case of Ibsen, you had Edmund Goss and Archer and Bernard Shaw and Granville Barker in England saying that these were great works at a time when all the critics of the Daily Telegraph and the Times were saying it's not only rubbish, it's nonsense. So that they had a terrific experience and they were trying to justify why this experience was so terrific. And if you read Shaw's Quintessence of Ibsenism, for example, you'll find a very brilliant explanation why Shaw was so moved by Ibsen. Now, this explanation is not entirely tenable today because he was more moved by the political and social side of Ibsen than by his poetic side. But the fact is that there is much political, sociological, and psychological in Ibsen that appealed to Shaw, and even if he didn't respond to other things that are in Ibsen, he has responded to enough of it to know that it was an important author, and he was right, you see. So I think if you look at the history of criticism, you'll find over and over again that there have been critics who were very discerning about certain writers who in their time were not highly appreciated. And one just can only hope that one is among those, you know, but I mean, I wouldn't claim that.
Writers of the absurd bringing to the theater?
I don't know what you mean by the younger generations of writers of the absurd, because I was just trying to explain that I think that after the first initial shock, one can't really talk about younger writers of the absurd. What I was saying was that younger writers are using the methods and techniques which have become part of the general convention of drama without necessarily being in that category. I think that the number of subject matters that can be dealt with this technique is relatively limited because they're all rather basic subject matters like the nature of man, the mystery of our existence, the difficulty of human communication, and so on. Now, most writers nowadays deal with those subjects as well as with lots of other subjects, political, philosophical, and others, social. And I think one can't really talk about, you see, the theater of the absurd itself is not a subject matter. We were talking about alienation just now. It is a method of dealing with subject matters which have always been with us. You know, all theater deals with loneliness, love, ambition, historical situations, and so on. And it's just a different methods of being applied. You can deal with any of these subjects by having a realistic approach or an absurdist approach or a romantic approach. And I think nowadays the younger generation of writers has a great choice in which methods to use. And that is something that the writers that are in my book, which I would call the writers of the absurdist group, have created, and that's them. There are no others.
I think we might have three more questions. One up here.
What connection then did you see historically between the death of the absurd and the Dadaism and surrealism, which started around 1910?
Yes. I wouldn't call it a culmination of them, but a continuation of tendencies which were present in Surrealism and Dadaism. Now, Dadaism was largely destructive, and really was a kind of anti-art to show the absurdity of art. Now, in a play like Ionesco's Bald Prima Donna, or Bald Soprano, whichever you call it, you have in fact got an absolutely Dadaist method, because you have people who are puppets mouthing senseless words. And you are reducing the theater to a kind of a puppet show of idiots, which is very funny, is very profound in some ways, but is a typically Dadaist approach. Now, many absurdist plays use this Dadaist approach. The Surrealists, on the other hand, historically are connected with Artaud, because Artaud was a member of the Surrealist group in the beginning, and he tried to create a Surrealist type of theater. Much of his theory of the theater comes out of Surrealism. But mainly, I think, what Surrealism created was a belief in the spontaneity of the expression of your experience without going through a lot of rules and a lot of rationalizations. And therefore, I think the writers like Ionesco or Beckett or Pinter were in a way liberated from the sense of guilt that previous writers would have felt if they just put down whatever came into their minds. And Ionesco has once described that he writes a play by looking at the ceiling, and then he sees little men doing strange things, and he writes that down. Now, that is a surrealist technique, and would have been regarded as totally unacceptable in a time when the writer was supposed to be a craftsman. Now, Ionesco is a great craftsman, but he's an instinctive craftsman. And in a way, you see, the surrealists themselves produced quite a lot of plays. People like Ribemont Desaigne and Desnos and Aragon wrote plays. But these plays never had any impact on the stage. And the curious thing is that I think that they wrote their plays in the surrealist technique by simply automatic writing. And because they didn't know much about the theater, they didn't have the instinctive sense of form that people like Ionesco and Beckett have. So that I think that Ionesco and Beckett have craftsmanship which is instinctive, which allows them to think that they're putting down what spontaneously occurs in their minds. So they are, in a way, a kind of dialectical modification of the surrealist technique. As indeed poets like Éluard are when they write poetry, because they have an instinctive sense of rhythm. And although they say there's automatic writing, the rhythm is there already as an instinct in them, so they have an instinctive sense of form. And in that sense, I think the Surrealists paved the way for the absurdists, as indeed did Jarry and Apollinaire and other writers in this vein long before the Surrealists. Question about the absurd in cinematography that one sometimes feels in films of this kind that one has been had, as it were, and manipulated. I personally think that it is very, very difficult to put the real absurdism into the cinema, because the cinema, by being photographic, has, I think, an enormous residue of realism that you can't get out of it. And that, I think, is the reason why, on the whole, dream sequences, for example, in the cinema, don't work as well as they work in the theater, because one is used to photographs being real, and one also knows that real people have been enacting them, you see. And I think there is a possibility of having absurdist cinema, and I've seen some very good absurdist cinema. There's also surrealist cinema, like the best films of Buñuel, particularly his latest ones, which I think, The Secret Charm of the Bourgeoisie is a marvelous surrealist film. I wouldn't call it absurdist so much, but it's surrealist because it uses the dislocation of consciousness in a very discreet way by using very realistic methods. But if you take a film, my favorite absurdist film is Polanski's film about the two men with the wardrobe. I don't know whether that is known here. In which you have nothing but the sea coast, and out of the sea emerge two men carrying a wardrobe. And they then go into the town and they try to get rid of it, and wherever they put it, on a garbage dump and so on, somebody discovers that it's theirs and they have to take it again. They can't get rid of it. And the film ends with them going back into the sea and disappearing into the surf with the wardrobe. Now that is a film which works perfectly well as cinema and is a perfect absurdist image. Now, I haven't seen this film more than twice. I couldn't analyze now why it works and why other things don't work. Perhaps it works because it's a perfect cinematic image, and yet it's of an absurdist image. And because it starts with a very surrealist concept of these men coming out of the sea and going back into the sea, one accepts it in a curious way.
Are they wet?
No, they're not. One accepts it, and I think it is possible to do that. Also in the television plays by Beckett that I mentioned, the imagery is so simple and so basic that the question of realism doesn't arise. And that, I think, is perhaps the secret. But I wouldn't want to commit myself on that because I really haven't thought very deeply about it. On the whole, I think that surrealism doesn't work very well in the cinema. If you think of the early surrealist films, like Artaud's La Coquille et le Clergyman, or Buñuel's Chien Andalou, or Le Sang d'un Poète by Cocteau, they are intriguing, but they don't really work because they are too consciously surrealist. And I think that Buñuel's later method of simply having a sort of dislocation of one's sense of realism by one detail that is wrong is probably a better way of approaching it. But there's still a lot of work to be done on absurdism and surrealism and the grotesque altogether in the cinema. I think Beckett himself regards Chaplin and Buster Keaton as the greatest absurdist artists of all time. And of course they were in the cinema and they really did do tremendous absurdist type of work. But again, in a different convention, they came out of the vaudeville and the music hall convention, which is already a highly stylized convention. Yes, I think Monty Python's Flying Circus is a triumphant application of the highbrow, or relatively highbrow, concepts of Beckett and Ionesco and all these people to popular entertainment. I think it's brilliant. And it is right up the mainstream of the popularization of absurdism from being a highbrow fad to popular mass entertainment. Mind you, it's still popular mass entertainment for the conoscenti. But I think many of the things that these people are putting on television will become commonplace absurdist techniques in popular entertainment. There's much evidence that this is already happening, certainly in England. The Goon Show was another radio program of the same kind, which is absolutely brilliant absurdist material.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we have imposed on our speaker sufficiently. I would like to make a few comments, if you will bear with me, because this is the final Institute lecture for this season. Those of you who wish to hear tonight's speaker again, he will be back on this campus in May for for a conference on Ibsen and the theater, and that will be May 9th to 12th, and I believe further information is available from Continuing Education. I'd like at this time to acknowledge the assistance which the Institute has received from a wide variety of people and operations. These include things like Continuing Education, the University Information Services, Biomedical Communications, which provides the audiovisual services in this building. I'd like also to express our appreciation to the Cecil and Ida Green Lectureship Program, to the Dal Grauer Lectureship, to the Vancouver Sun Lectureship, for their support of speakers who we have enjoyed at the Institute this year. In addition, I would like to express our appreciation to our members and donors, both individual and corporate, through whose support the Institute is maintained, and I think you would agree, thrives. I would also like to express my personal appreciation to the executive and council of the Institute this past year. Particularly, I think, if the